Welcome to the Finance Podcast. The topic of this episode, update from the world of digital assets 2024 with Adrian Fritz from 21 Shares.
Before I start, who's speaking English? Two person thing? Okay, a few. Perfect. I'm going to do it in English then. Better for me as well. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the most exciting presentation of this event. I don't know why we don't have a bigger room. It kind of feels like a support group of the anonymous Bitcoin holders here. But we're definitely going to have a lot of fun. Because we're so small, feel free to make it very interactive. Feel free to scream questions. It should be kind of like at an auction. Before we start off, I just want to ask, like, who already knows 21 Shares? Would be okay. Who already invested in Bitcoin? Okay. Who's super skeptical? Damn it. Who has a non-custodial wallet? Like a fan? Okay. All right, okay. I try to adjust my pitch usually, because if they're skeptics, I gotta go a bit more basic. But as we have like a lot of Bitcoin enthusiasts, we can go a bit faster. So just a recap on 21 Shares. For those who don't know us, we are a Swiss-based ETF and ETP issuer. What we do is we provide really, really easy access via exchange-traded products and exchange-traded funds. In Europe, we have, in total, we have over 40 products. We have exactly 40 products in Europe listed in more than 10 stock exchanges. And here we really cover, of course, Bitcoin, Ethereum, but kind of like what sets us apart is that we have a massive offering also in terms of the long tail. So a lot of altcoins. You have a question already? Of course.
Explain the difference, please, between ETF and ETP.
That's a wonderful question. So the ETPs in Europe, they exist for more than 5 years already. The big difference is in terms of the structure. So to take it, to be very exact, an ETP is basically a debt structure. However, it's 100% collateralized. In Switzerland, they title this an ETP, while in Germany, for instance, it would be considered an ETC, an exchange-traded commodity. So similar to gold ETCs in Germany, for instance, they physically backed 100%, but to be really exact, they're like a debt structure. Now the question is, why don't we have ETFs in Europe? That's because of UCITS regulations. You kind of need to fulfill a certain amount of diversification, and that's impossible on a single underlying. And therefore, we don't have UCITS ETFs on crypto assets. And that's kind of like the difference. Well, an ETF, obviously, is like a fund structure where you basically have direct ownership of the fund and the underlying. Does it make sense?
Yes, but in Switzerland, there is not this restriction.
Sorry?
In Switzerland, there's no restriction on a single underlying ETF.
There's not, but it might be more expensive, yes. But in terms of, I mean, in terms of the structure and how it feels for the end investor, it's the exact same feeling in the end. And also in terms of, because it's 100% physically backed, we're always able to fulfill creation and redemptions. Again, we have around 40 products in Europe. And now, from the beginning of the year, we open up the U.S. market. We in the U.S., we partnered with ARK Invest and Cathie Woods, and we launched our first U.S. Bitcoin spot ETF, which now has close to $3 billion in assets under management, which is obviously a massive success story for us as well. And in total, we're managing $6.5 billion. Our company already exists for more than 5 years. It feels like 50 in crypto. But yeah, we've been around for a long time, especially providing access to crypto here in Europe. Now, yeah, this is just more a visualization how we see ourselves. We really want to do this bridge between traditional finance and crypto. And we do this with our products, where we basically close this gap between the two worlds. But we also have the same approach with our research, where we're really trying to speak the language of traditional clients, and that's why we discuss topics that are more appealing to traditional investors. Something like valuation frameworks, how crypto fits in a traditional portfolio, or just talking about the product structure itself. Again, the benefits of an ETP and an ETF, they're evident. Obviously, the good thing is we partner, or we kind of collaborate with banks and brokers. First of all, for banks, obviously the money stays in their accounts. It's all physically backed. There's no need for a wallet. It's all basically handled. Now, I just want to give a little recap for 2024. It's kind of like crazy how many things already happened this year. Obviously, the big bang was started off in January 2024 when the SEC finally approved Bitcoin spot ETFs in the US. And I think the launch of those ETFs can't be understated. Those ETFs were able to capture $10 billion in under 2 months. Gold ETFs, they took around 2 years to capture the same AUM. And just in total, the Bitcoin spot ETF launch was the most successful ETF launch in financial history, just in terms of volume and gathering of AUM. So it really shows that there is appetite, investor appetite, and slow institutional adoption coming from bigger players also in the States. On the technical side, we had the Ethereum Denkun upgrade. For those who don't know, Ethereum kind of like suffers from high transaction fees. It can be very slow and expensive. That's why we have a lot of layer twos building on top of it to help with scalability. And the Denkun upgrade basically tried to improve the scalability and improve the costs on those layer twos in order to onboard more users and kind of compete with the Solanas and the like. Then obviously, a few days ago, we had the Bitcoin halving. We're definitely going to discuss this a bit more. Obviously, a big event. I love the Bitcoin halving because it's such a big event. Good morning, Marco.
Good morning.
The Bitcoin halving is obviously a crazy event in the news. Everyone talks about it. There's a lot of attention. But the date or the upgrade itself is actually really, really boring. Another big news are ETFs in Hong Kong that are going to launch anytime soon, which kind of like shows adoption in the Far East, which will also drive adoption. And we also seen in the UK that the FCA recently announced that they are open to list exchange-traded notes at the LSE. However, they will only be available for professional investors at the beginning. And then, I'm sure there's a lot happening for the rest of the year. We're still waiting for the Fed's interest rate cuts. I don't know if it's going to be 3 or 2 or how many, but it's just a matter of time until those interest rates come down. And usually that should favor risk on assets as well because it provides more liquidity into the market. U.S. presidential election, also important for the stock market. Usually before the presidential election, we have a bit more volatility, while historically after the election, we kind of moved into a rally because who wants to be president in a bear market, right? Ethereum spot ETF is still on the radar. We have a first decision next month. So I can't tell you much about the actual application and everything. I think the odds are, I would say 50-50. Who knows what's going to happen? But the question around an Ethereum spot ETF is, for me at least, more a when rather than if. It's going to happen eventually. Then, yeah, to speed up a little bit in terms of regulation, we see a lot of progress. The MiCA is going to be implemented by the end of the year, which hopefully boosts the European crypto ecosystem as well. So they have an easier job to passport their work across the continent. And then another Bitcoin new all-time high, hopefully. I truly believe this is again a start of a new bull market and that we will see higher highs than we just did a few weeks ago. Now, let's just dive into the halving real quick. Who doesn't understand how the halving works? I love it. Everyone does. I mean, the beauty of the halving, as you all know, is just that supply shock and that the block rewards are cut in half. So now, at the moment, we sit at the block reward of 3.125 blocks. Again, it happens all 4 years. Or to be really precise, it happens every 210,000 blocks. And that's also the reason why we never know the exact date and time when the halving actually takes place. Another insight, maybe you didn't know, there will be a total of 32 halvings in total. And we will reach the maximum supply of Bitcoin in the year 2140. What you see here is the actual total number of Bitcoin. That's the max supply of Bitcoin that will ever be in existence. I know we always round up and talk about 21 million Bitcoin, but to be really precise, if you go through the source code, that's what you end up with at the very, very end. So a few Satoshis short of those 21 million. Now, let's talk about the ETF flows. I mean, the buying pressure and the reason why we reached a new all-time high prior to the halving is definitely due to the ETFs, just the narrative that it built up and the inflows we've seen so far. So here on the left, we basically see the newborn nine, I would say. So all the ETFs, excluding GBTC. And if we're just looking at the buying pressure, now, this slide is a bit outdated again, but we're now at over 500,000 Bitcoin that those ETFs accumulated in the first 3 months, which is absolutely nuts. If you look at the issuance rate, there's around 450 Bitcoin that come into circulation at the moment, but you have like those ETFs buy 3 to 5 times that amount. So this demand obviously outpaces the supply. There is a little caveat, though. If we include GBTC, GBTC is still the reason for most of the selling pressure in the market. If we look at the net flows, if we take GBTC into account as well, obviously we wouldn't reach 500,000 Bitcoin, but it's still over 200,000 Bitcoins net inflows via those ETFs, which is crazy. Think about it, 450 Bitcoins a day, if we annualize that, that's an issuance of around 165,000 Bitcoin a year from now on. 165K per year Bitcoin are coming into circulations. Those ETFs, including GBTC, already bought more the post-annualized halving issuance. So if that obviously continues, it kind of like feeds into that supply shock narrative. And here on the right side, just a comparison of Bitcoin versus gold, where we can see those Bitcoin ETFs hold 55 billion, while gold ETFs are close to 100 billion, kind of like sees where, can see where the direction is going for this emerging store of value. Now, that's one of my favorite charts because we're absolutely obsessed with on-chain analysis. We truly believe that on-chain analytics will become an essential part of the capital markets of the future. So obviously, you're going to have your technical analysis, your fundamental analysis, cap markets, but you also have to take into account on-chain analytics. What we see here are the so-called Bitcoin long-term holder supply. That's basically, what is a long-term holder? A long-term holder is any wallet that hasn't moved any bitcoins for the last 155 days. So people holding on to their assets. What we can see here in black are basically is the Bitcoin price logarithmic. And here in orange, we see those long-term holders. Now, what we can observe is really nice, actually. First of all, just looking at the amount they hold around 14 million Bitcoin. Meaning, out of 19.7 million Bitcoin, 14 million Bitcoin haven't moved for over 155 days. So you have this massive amount of illiquid supply. It's basically people that just hold on to their asset. Now we can go a bit deeper and just check how they behave, which is really interesting. We see here in 2017-18, the ICO craze, we see before that an accumulation. And then once the bull market kicks off, those long-term holders, they sell into the strength of the market. We could see this here during the ICO craze, but we also saw it during the last bull market, where you see an accumulation, but then you see kind of like those long-term holders selling into strength. Now, who are those people? I would say, first of all, what you see here is a lot of people that maybe may have lost their private keys, so they're never going to move their Bitcoin again. It might be a lot of people that just hold on to their assets, they huddle for dear life. And lastly, it's definitely people that got burned in the last cycle, but now stay in the market. Because imagine you invested here at 69K for the first time ever, you're begging to get out at break even. You're begging. And obviously, once we reach that point, those people might take out their money. However, if you just look at the overall trend, we clearly see that the supply side is becoming increasingly illiquid. The same is on exchanges, obviously. That's also where the ETFs source their coins. And especially since FTX, we see that more and more Bitcoins are withdrawn from exchanges. Obviously, there are several reasons for that. Counterparty risk, I think, especially after FTX, a lot of people say, I'd rather do self-custody or go via an ETP, ETF. But we clearly see that there's not many Bitcoin left on exchanges. And yeah, just to bring it all together, I think for me, it's still a perfect setup for a supply shock at one point. I mean, on the one hand, as we discussed, I think the microenvironment is going to improve eventually and be in favor for crypto assets. The ETF buying pressure, I think that's just a start. What we've seen until now in the US also is mostly retail driven. It's basically family offices, maybe hedge funds, high net worth individuals. But those big allocators, they're going to take another 6 to 12 months until they really make an investment. They got to go through compliance, management approval, fund selection, until they really decide to make this allocation within a multi-asset portfolio. I think it's going to take a bit more time. And lastly, just the adoption that if we look at smaller retail or just people that start dabbling into Bitcoin, they never really cared about the price. On the supply side, long-term holder supply, as we discussed, decreasing balance on exchanges, and then we recently had the Bitcoin halving supply shock. And just a combination of all those things is, for me, really basic economics and paint a really bullish picture for Bitcoin overall. Any questions so far? Yes?
If you go back to the slide, when you have price and long-term holders, that one.
Yeah.
If we zoom in on, for example, 2018, it looks like investors know something that others don't, because as the price is moving up, they're selling off until it reaches the minimum point on the yellow line, and that incidentally is also the maximum point on the price, and then as price starts to fall, they start to accumulate, right?
Yeah.
So this looks like they're really timing the market well here.
Like the hive mind seems to time the market well, basically, yeah. That's why it's really fascinating to see that, absolutely. I agree. Now I want to move a bit more in depth, and I want to talk a bit beyond the halving. Obviously, the question we get a lot is, what happens if all Bitcoin are mined? what is the incentive for the network to keep it safe? Well, it is the transaction fees. I mean, miners earn block rewards, but they also earn transaction fees. And there's a lot of cool stuff happening on top of Bitcoin at the moment, in my opinion. We've seen something like Ordinals and BRC20s, basically NFT-like applications built on top of Bitcoin, which generate a lot of transaction fees. We have the newest innovation, our runes. Runes is just another fancy word for also kind of like fungible tokens built on top of Bitcoin. And then we have layer twos, like for instance, Stacks. And I'm a big fan of Stacks personally because it's really bringing Ethereum-like capabilities on top of Bitcoin. A lot of people say Bitcoin might be too rigid, might be a bit stiff, maybe a bit boring, because most of the people just hold it in their wallet. They don't do much with their Bitcoin. However, those layer twos also enable kind of like a smart contract type of capabilities on top of Bitcoin. And we see the early innings of that. There's already like decentralized exchanges, lending protocols, we're going to see trading protocols, NFTs, and much, much more, all building on top of a layer two, which in the end builds on top of Bitcoin. And that kind of will subsidize and compensate for those reduced block rewards in the future. And I think that's super, super interesting. Any questions here? Yes?
So we saw as you know, show here, an increase in transaction fees.
Yeah.
And so the white paper, I'm going to play devil's advocate here real quick.
Oh, let's go.
The white paper said, you know, electronic cash system.
Yes.
So peer-to-peer transactions.
Absolutely.
And then you see now this massive increase that I didn't expect it in transaction fees.
Yeah.
So what can we expect for 2028 then?
That's a very good question. I mean, this topic is a bit polarizing because a lot of Bitcoin maxis, they oppose to the idea that we have something like NFTs or smart contracts on top of Bitcoin. So I don't know if there's a right answer. I think it's just dividing the community a little bit because obviously if we look at the transaction fees on Bitcoin around the halving, they were at like $140. And that obviously puts out a lot of smaller people that want to do transactions because they can't pay for the block space. I mean, I really believe that, I guess the solution here is to move on to another layer, just like the Lightning Network has been trying to do, to leverage the Bitcoin network as a settlement layer while having the scalability built on top of Bitcoin. But I totally understand and I agree that a lot of Bitcoin maximalists or Bitcoin OGs, they kind of oppose to that idea. Yeah, I brought some portfolio allocation because I think it's really important to see how Bitcoin behaves in a portfolio. Who was at my presentation last year? Was anyone? Yeah? Because last year when I was here, Bitcoin was at 24K, 23K. And I already made the case, and this slide looked almost the exact same. It's always the same picture. And I hope I don't have to be here next year and we're at 100K and people still don't get it. What we see here basically is a traditional 60-40 portfolio. Here we have a really long time horizon from 2014 till January 2024. Now you're going to say, Adrian, this is outdated. I chose this specifically because here the Bitcoin price was still at around 35K-ish or 40. Obviously, now it would look even better. What we can see here for the benchmark over this time horizon is that the annual return is around 8%. Here on the right, we have a 5% Bitcoin allocation, but with different rebalancing strategies. So if we sprinkle some Bitcoin, 5%, we can see that the performance goes up on an annualized basis to 41%, which is amazing. The big problem is the volatility, it goes up to 49% of the overall portfolio, which is absolute crap and unacceptable, obviously. However, and that's kind of like a key finding with different time periods, with different allocations, it's always the same. It comes down to the right rebalancing strategy. Because only with the rebalancing, you're able to capture the upside potential of Bitcoin while mitigating the downside risk, which is expressed by better risk-adjusted returns. So let's look at the quarterly rebalancing, for instance. Annual return goes up from 8 to 16. Awesome. However, the volatility only goes up from 13 to 15%, which is expressed by the Sharpe ratio. So we clearly see that the small allocation is beneficial for the overall return. It's great, no? Who doesn't want to have Bitcoin in a portfolio? I don't get it. I mean, it just makes sense. It has a low correlation to other assets. I mean, no one's talking about 50% in a Bitcoin in a multi-asset portfolio, but a small sprinkle, in my opinion, it's almost careless not to have it in a portfolio over the next 10 years. I want to move away from Bitcoin a little bit, and I know you guys are a bit more deeper into the weeds, so I want to get a bit more technical and maybe make this an open discussion as well. Ethereum, of course, we don't have much time anymore. Only 3 minutes, is that true? Ten. Okay, great. Okay. So obviously Ethereum, I want to highlight Ethereum a little bit because I believe it's been in the shadow of Bitcoin over the last 12 months. Of course, everything was around Bitcoin. The US banking crisis last year, people were, Bitcoin performed 40%, then slowly the ETFs and the rumors coming in. The whole narrative was around Bitcoin, but I truly believe that Ethereum has been in the shadows. Now, Ethereum really remains the financial hub of the crypto ecosystem. Like over 50% of all stable coins, they all based on top of Ethereum. Here, what we see on the left side is just how popular staking is. And we see that more than 25% of all circulating ETH are currently being staked. So there's evidently demand for a crypto native staking yield, just like the one from Ethereum. And I would see this increase even more once like interest rates are coming down and you get less yield from, let's say, US Treasuries. Obviously, this becomes way more attractive just in terms of opportunity costs. And then what we always forget is that Ethereum is a deflationary asset. The more activity we have on the network, the more ETH is being burned, and therefore this asset is becoming deflationary, which is wonderful, obviously. What else is happening on top? Oh, of course, a big narrative is tokenization. Everybody is talking about tokenization. All the big banks are talking about tokenization. The big problem, and what I hate when people say this, they say, we believe in the blockchain, but we don't believe in crypto. It doesn't make any sense. The two are like a symbiosis. They live together. Because only if you want to have a decentralized, global, neutral settlement layer, you also need a neutral crypto asset that fuels that entire ecosystem. And you can only achieve that with a crypto asset, like ETH, for instance. And that's what people don't get. The crypto asset itself ensures the neutrality and decentralization of the underlying settlement layer. Because again, what we're building here is a value layer for the internet. Just like TCP/IP, which was used for information, we're now building a layer worldwide protocol where we can exchange value, money, assets. And tokenization is one of the biggest, obviously, catalysts for that. And what we see here is just tokenized US treasuries on the blockchain. And we can clearly see a massive trend here, and we currently crossed the 1 billion mark in terms of AUM. Of course, 1 billion is not a lot in the fixed income world, but it's clearly a trend that we can see. One big one was obviously Biddle from BlackRock. So they also use the Ethereum blockchain to tokenize one of their funds. That's that little uptick here, which is fascinating to see. Any questions to Ethereum? Who's invested in Ethereum? Yes, sir. Now, what else is happening in the crypto space? A lot. Normally, when we talk to people that are still at the beginning of their journey, it's really about time to educate yourself. I tell this every family office, investment advisor, you really got to educate yourself now, because it's kind of like a paradise for multi-asset portfolio managers. There's so many cool things happening in crypto. I just put a few titles here, which I think are really interesting. Obviously, Solana. Solana has its own problems with outages, or now with kind of like spam on the network. So we have a lot of transactions that don't go through. But I can tell you, Solana, for me, in terms of user experience, it is the best blockchain in terms of user experience. It really feels like you're using an iPhone or an OS. I think the technical hurdle is coming down significantly. And I think Solana is the best example for that. So again, it has its problems, but it's really good in onboarding new users with low transaction fees and fast throughput. Layer 2s. Now, after the Dankun upgrade, we will see more thriving ecosystems building on top of Layer 2s. Here, Layer 2s on Ethereum, like Arbitrum, Optimism, ZK-Sync, Base from Coinbase, but also what I mentioned, Stacks, for instance, building on top of Bitcoin. Restaking, another controversial but quite big narrative in crypto. Does everyone know what restaking is? Okay, yeah? So restaking basically is when a validator on the Ethereum network stakes their assets, they basically have to validate transactions and they get rewarded for that. Now, restaking is basically like a little side hustle, like a side job. You basically take your assets, your staked assets, again, and you use it for a different job. For instance, the validator could act as an oracle and provide price data to the blockchain, like another task they have to fulfill. And for that, they are rewarded with even more yield. And that's kind of like what restaking is enabling. And it's been high in demand, but it also poses risks because it's getting more and more complex, everything. So the implications could be dire as well. I think DeFi is really important to look at, because Uniswap just tried to make the so-called fee switch. Now, those DeFi apps, they have a big problem, which is that their token is basically useless. For instance, the Uniswap token, the UNI token, it's a governance token, but it doesn't really accrue any value or doesn't have any utility aside from voting rights for any protocol changes. However, what they proposed is a so-called fee switch, meaning there's a lot of trading happening on top of Uniswap, and now a little cut of those trading fees, they go back to UNI token holders. And that's obviously massive, because now you have this revenue participation for token holders. And that changes the entire investment case for a token like that, in my opinion. The SEC went right ahead and sued them. And we will see how it's going to play out. But I believe that this is just the start of some of those applications changing their business model. Yes?
A follow-up question on Uniswap.
Yeah.
some analysts, including K33, has argued that if you try to implement fees, users can just go to another decentralized exchange because there's really no barriers to switch from trading on Uniswap versus trading on SushiSwap or other decentralized exchanges. Do you think that this will happen as they try to monetize the users, that they just flee to another lower fee environment?
What do you mean by monetizing users? So it's long been in discussion. So usually, if you trade on Uniswap, you have to pay a transaction fee. This fee, as of now, only goes to liquidity providers, for me, from to me, for instance. Now, what they're kind of discussing is that a part of that pie that goes to liquidity providers will now go to token holders.
And then the liquidity providers go to another
exactly.
place.
That's kind of like the bigger risk, that why it's always been in discussion, because it might be that liquidity providers then go to a different protocol because they get a higher yield. Absolutely, absolutely. That's why it's still not set in stone, and that's why it hasn't been implemented until now. But usually they go where the liquidity is as well, especially the users. You go to the exchange where the highest liquidity is because you can be sure you have the lowest spreads and impact. And lastly, we have gaming and AI. I think gaming and AI is definitely a narrative people should take a look at. Gaming has been already big in the last cycle, but the games have been quite shit, to be honest. They were just glorified DeFi applications. But I think in this cycle, for the first time, we will see actual cool games that people can play that are powered by blockchain technology. And lastly, AI. I mean, the combination of blockchain and AI, it's massive. I think we will see a convergence of those two technologies, because I think, especially now with the US presidential elections, there's a lot of deep fakes out there. Do you know what deep fake videos are? Yes. They look sick. They look so freaking real now. It's unbelievable. I remember like a year ago, you could still see it, but now they're getting better and better and better. And it poses massive risk. Like in 2016, the US presidential elections, they were influenced by Twitter bots. While now you have those deep fake videos. It's crazy. And that's why you need to have a technology where you can prove that a certain piece of digital content is 100% authentic, like a digital cryptographic signature. And you can only do this with blockchain technology. So if a president uploads a video, he can tokenize it, make an NFT out of it, and anybody in the world can verify and check if this piece of content is 100% authentic. And I think that's beautiful. And I think we see more of that coming together. But yeah, that's it. We have one more minute. Any more questions or any cool narrative that I forget to mention and I should look into? Yes?
Regarding your ETPs,
yes,
in Europe, can you say something about the flows?
In terms of flows,
yes.
To be really honest, the flows over the last couple of weeks and months, they have been a bit muted. While in the US, obviously, we've seen massive inflows. So it seems like a lot of investors in Europe are still hesitant. Some of them might have even switched to a US product. But in terms of comparing those two markets, flows have been almost zero in Europe, while compared in the US, it was over 2 billion net new inflows. Yes. But what's interesting is, especially end of last year, Solana, for instance, had massive inflows in our products. And Solana is actually one of our biggest ETPs now with it was more than 1 billion a few weeks ago. I think it's now a few million short of that. Any more questions? No?
One question.
Of course.
About the derivative space related to the Bitcoin and, you know, cryptos in general.
Yes.
With all the ETFs now, you know, it's more easy to, you know, play with the derivatives. How's that going to impact? Have you seen any impact of that?
Obviously, they're important as well, especially what I can tell from an ETP, ETF point of view, especially last year, we've seen a lot of hedge funds doing a basis trade. And here we're talking about large financial institutions as well that basically trying to capture or looking for that difference between the futures and the spot. And what they basically did is they used our ETPs for the long leg while shorting the CME in order to capture that. Mm. So I think we will see more strategies like that, but obviously it requires a certain level of expertise and sophistication. But in terms of structure, product, strategies, I think we will see definitely more of that, which I find pretty exciting, yes. I think that's it. Well, thank you so much and see you next year.
Finally, the mandatory risk warning. The content of this episode is for general information only and is not a recommendation to buy or sell any financial products. All information is supplied without guarantee, and this is not an investment advisory.